Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to hear it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I would like to welcome Jack Leffler. He is a writer, oral historian, and radio producer. And his latest book is Survival Along the Continental Divide, an anthology of interviews published by University of New Mexico Press. And he will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore this Friday, May 23rd at 5:30 in the afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. This is an incredible book of conversations with you and thinkers across a really wide cultural divide and geographical spectrum here in the West. Now, the book isn't really exactly about the continental divide, but why did you choose that geographical boundary to name the book?
Well, actually, a lot of the interviews occur just on either side of the continental divide, in the southern aspect of it. And the cover of the book, by the way, the dust jacket, has a map of that was rendered by John Wesley Powell in 1889 and 90 that shows the arid regions of the West. And at one point, you can almost imagine where the Continental Divide is there. And almost everybody in this book addresses subjects which are relevant to successful living along the Continental Divide.
For those of our listeners who might not know exactly what is the Continental Divide?
The Continental Divide, it's wonderful. East of the Continental Divide, all of the water flows eastward into the Atlantic at some point, and west of the Continental Divide, it flows westward. The major drainages west of the Continental Divide within what's known as the Intermountain West, which is bounded on the east by the Rocky Mountains and on the west by the Sierra Cascade Ranges, actually has three different major river systems that drain it. The Columbia Snake Yakima system that empties into the Pacific down the Columbia River, the Colorado, which includes the Green, San Juan, and other rivers, which empties into the Sea of Cortez, or used to when there was still water getting that far, and our own Rio Grande. However, the Rio Grande lies west of the Continental Divide, and it flows into the Gulf of Mexico, and the other two rivers flow west of the Continental Divide. The Rio Grande is east of the Continental Divide. I have dyslexia of east and west, which is curious. But at any rate, the Continental Divide is a major factor in the way water is in the West. And the arid West lies west of the 100th meridian, which kind of goes right down through the middle of the contiguous 48 states. And the verdant East is entirely dissimilar to the arid West, and that's one of the things that we have to contend with, and that's in large measure what this book finally addresses, is survival in the arid West along the Continental Divide.
Well, and survival is really the operative word here, if we don't think about water and we don't think about our relationship to nature above all water, we are in great trouble. One of the interesting essays, but interviews that you have in the book really talks about the understanding of watersheds, and this is on the cover of the book, the understanding of the West in terms of watersheds, which was John Wesley Powell's great vision, dividing up this part of the country not by counties but by watersheds, which almost succeeded but then did not.
Thanks to people like William Gilpin, who later became the governor of Colorado. But basically, one of the things that really happened back in the 19th century was a lot of people from the East were looking at the landscape west of the 100th meridian and trying to figure out ways of turning habitat into money. And that, to me, was one of the grim mistakes. John Wesley Powell, my friends Bill DeBuise and Gary Snyder both regard John Wesley Powell is the very first of the bioregional thinkers, and this would have been in the 19th century, which is amazing. And indeed, this map reflects most of the 150 or so watersheds that he identified from horseback, which is amazing. And his whole notion was is that people within each of these watersheds could take control of the nature of their home habitat in a decentralized fashion. They'd still be part of the United States, but the states would not be organized by geopolitical boundaries, but rather by watershed boundaries. A watershed being sort of the cradle that holds water within a given region, the Rio Grande being a spectacular example right around here. But even closer to home, the Santa Fe River watershed is surrounded by hills, the tops of which mark the boundary of the watershed. And it extends from its headwaters up in a cirque. I've actually been there. It's really terrific. And then it drains down and finally empties into the Rio Grande. And that is our home watershed. And then it's running a bit low.
It's running a bit low. Say more about that.
Well, I've had the opportunity over the last few, well, the last year especially, to do a fair number of lectures around New Mexico concerning water. And one of the things that's been revealed to me is that the aquifers, which is the underground water or the groundwater, which is different than the surface water, which is the streams, our aquifers are 60%, possibly more, pumped out at this point. This is not good news. We have a diminishing amount of water on the surface. And the indications, thanks to global warming and climate change, seem to indicate that over the next 30, 35 years, the American Southwest may receive even up to 30% less precipitation than we do now. Now, this is in an area where our water is wildly overallocated even now. And so, should we indeed run out of water, we're going to have to really move.
We're going to have to really move. It's happened before, ladies and gentlemen, where people have had to move. But it's. I mean, one of the things I like about the book is that it's not just. It's not just an ecological point of view, but it's you have historians, all sorts of cultural artists and thinkers and people who are looking at it from a spiritual and philosophical point of view and an economic point of view, and this is all integrated. And there's a couple of different times in the book where you kind of question the value of an excessive analytical reductionism and rather try to look at the whole picture.
Well, I think that that's where we have failed as a culture, is to look at the whole picture. We have become a very reductionist thinking culture in many ways. That's the way our educational system seems to train us to be. But
meaning everybody is specialized and they don't know each other's niches, so to speak?
Yes, and in a very linear sort of a way. And what I'm hoping for is that as a culture, we can achieve a sphere of reference point of view rather than the linear point of view to which we're accustomed. About 40 some odd years ago, I had a wonderful moment where I realized that if it was really important for me to pull all of the nails out of my frame of reference and start over again.
Easier said than done.
Much easier said than done. But nonetheless, the way I try to look at this anymore and the way I've tried to put this book together is to create a sphere of reference that has clusters of associated notions within it. And where we would apply our linear thinking is to go from cluster to cluster to try to extrapolate future probabilities. If we look at the many, many factors that are facing us today, we realize that it's almost an overwhelming barrage. But what I've tried to do in this book, by presenting people of Native American persuasion as well as Hispano persuasion, as well as different points of view, in other words, there are politicians, authors, just all sorts of interesting
I love persons. That phrase, Native American persuasion.
Well, they persuaded the right way, in my estimation. The two great people who are in this book, one, Rena Swensel, who was from the Santa Clara Pueblo, who to me is one of the most brilliant people on the planet, and another friend, a Navajo gentleman by the name of Roy Cady, both have perspectives that differ, but are infinitely more encompassing than the normal perspective that we find everywhere else. Let's face it, we're dominated in this culture by an economic political, corporate, military paradigm, which has pretty much shut down our capabilities of perceiving in a more sensitive way to where we live. And part of our project, part of our life project, cultural project, is to live in some sort of sustainable way with our home habitat. And to me, that's absolutely critical to do, and we have to foster that notion in ever greater degree right now. We're really running behind.
Well, and in the interview in the book, Rena Swenzel herself is talking about the rapid changes in Pueblo culture and how even there you're seeing an increase in that feeling of separation between people and nature.
Absolutely, and that prevails in every Native American culture I've visited. Over the last 40-some-odd years, I've visited and either lived with or spent a lot of time with people from as far north as the Nez Perce country to as far south as Chiapas. And there are elderly Native American peoples within all of those cultures who recognize a much more sacred relationship, that the landscape itself is sacred, and we are a part of that landscape. We cannot separate ourselves from the larger biotic community. We share infinitely more than just pure biology with all of these other life forms. That we're all basically descended from the same life urge. And this is something that seems to be intuitively known among at least traditional indigenous peoples. But it's something which we seem to have factored out over the last who knows how long, centuries at this point perhaps, from our thinking. And somehow, if we can resurrect this, I want to say this right now. This is, to me, a book of hope rather than a doomsday book. Actually, I've recently been regarded by some as a doomsday sort of a person, which to me is totally erroneous. I think that that's an epithet that's being bandied about by folks who are not really confronting the evidence that we're looking at today. And I think that we have to be open-minded and confront the very real evidence, the scientific evidence, the cultural evidence that we're looking at, and then try to wend our way through a huge common dilemma, which has many, many factors. And that's what this book is trying to do, is to set a standard of thinking by looking at lots of different points of views to see how to begin to wend our cultural way through this enormous dilemma.
We're talking to Jack Loeffler. The book is called Survival Along the Continental Divide, an anthology of interviews. As you have said in the book, or you've discussed in the book with the various people whom you interview, it's not just about finding technological solutions to our problems, although that's part of it, but wisdom in application of those solutions is every bit as important. And where do we find that wisdom? What is that wisdom?
Well, to give you an example, where I think that a lot of that wisdom can come from, in other words, there's an intrinsic wisdom that a lot of the indigenous people of North America and every place else have, because they have been successful. Their cultures have evolved within the context of their habitat. Except the ones that didn't. And that's now, but there's a different evolution there, a different form of cultural evolution. And so what I'm going to say here is that if we look to the very best within the context of those of us who did not come to cultural consciousness within their respective habitats, say of Santa Fe, I sure didn't. I was born in West Virginia, but I got here as quick as I could. but the upshot being that there is a possible collaborative effort that can be brought to bear between people who are, say, bioscientists who have a really deep sense of the whole biological point of view within the context of the geophysical continuum wherein we live. And if a collaboration can occur between those people and, say, the indigenous elders to create a bigger point of view, I think that that's a great place to start. And I'll give you a solid example, which does not occur in this book. But I have two very dear friends, Gary Paul Nabhan and Laurie Monty. They're a married couple. Gary is an ethnobotanist. Laurie is an ecologist, or ethnologist, or is it an echo? ethno-ecologist. Kind of hard to remember that one. But at any rate, for the last 8 or 10 years, the three of us have been working very closely with Sari Indians down in Mexico on the coast of the Sea of Cortez. These are among the last of the hunter-gatherers in North America. My part has been to record lore and music, and they have an entire repertoire of songs, the Sari Indians, who, by the way, their linguistic phylum is present nowhere else, as far as we know. They're the last speakers of that linguistic phylum. But they have an entire repertoire of songs, and each one of these songs focuses on a given species within the context of their ecosystem. If you understand, if you're a Sari Indian, and you understand the entire repertoire of these songs, you have a good understanding of what Sari taxonomy must be. Now, Gary and Laurie have been focusing on the ecological concerns down there, and they bring their scientific understanding to Sari culture, and instead of just trying to overwhelm the Saris with it, they work within the context of Sari culture in a collaborative way, or as Edward O. Wilson would say, in a state of consilience, where these two great fields are jumping together, coming together.
Well, but so staying with that example, what does it get everybody when you have those two things coming together? In other words, when you understand the Sari taxonomy as opposed to the Western science taxonomy?
Well, one of the things it does is create a sense of understanding of the home habitat that does not commonly prevail in Western culture anymore. We've neglected that big time. We have here in northern New Mexico many Native American peoples. This is really interesting to me. This is one of the most indigenously diverse habitats in North America. And if we listen
meaning New Mexico?
New Mexico, yeah. Or let's say the Rio Grande watershed.
Mm-hmm.
Getting back into watershed
right.
thinking. But we have all of the Puebloan people who have different points of view, but very similar points of view as to how to survive here. If we listen to those people, especially with regard to water, they understand how to use water and how to not misuse water in large measure. Granted, there are some golf courses around that shouldn't be here because of the expenditure of water, but in the main, the indigenous peoples understand how to use water in a way that doesn't overburden the watershed. Conversely, a lot of the Hispano people who have been here now for 400 years also understand how to use water in a wonderful way with the acequia systems, which are true models of how to keep the watershed in a healthy fashion, how to keep the biota within the watershed in a healthy fashion. And if we take that kind of indigenous knowledge, and I truly regard the Hispano people as being indigenous after four centuries of being here, these cultures have certainly, they've grown up here. They've been formed by the habitat in large measure. That's not the only factor, but that's certainly a big one. But if we can then come to some kind of bearing on looking at this, let's face it, the population of this watershed has increased by 100% since about 1973, maybe even a little better than 100%. We're right on the very edge, if we haven't already, of having exceeded the carrying capacity, the human carrying capacity of the watershed. We certainly have, if we look at the way we expend water very frivolously. We have to really look at what's happening here, and by that I mean we look at the fact that our aquifers are at least 60% depleted right here.
Well, when you say frivolously, 90% of our water goes to agriculture.
Well, when look what's grown. We have to, it's at more like, I don't even think it's quite 80% anymore, but it used to be well over 80% of our water goes to agriculture. Now, this is largely Anglo agriculture work, or maybe a mixture of relative newcomers using that water for agriculture. The true water wars, which are about to occur, I do believe, I think these will be paper water wars, at least I hope so, will be occurring between the agriculturalists and urban and industrial people.
You're listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. That was odd, ladies and gentlemen. But it is coming up to 8:30 here on KSFR, and we're talking to Jack Loeffler about his book, Survival Along the Continental Divide.
That was sort of a non sequitur.
Indeed it was. What on earth were we talking about?
Well, as far as I recall, we were talking about basically the coming point of view between agriculturalists and urban growth. And it's one of those almost unsolvable problems at this point, because here's this wonderful tradition of people having been self-sustainable with regard to agriculture. And now people who have very little notion, in other words, the urban population of any city has very little notion of really where a lot of the water comes from, where a lot of the food comes from. This is part of the bigger picture that I'm trying to get across here. This is one of those clusters of associated factors that fit within a larger sphere of reference here. But basically, what I'm trying to get across is that the water, which is the, to me, biggest issue in the American Southwest right now, it's finite. It's being pumped out of the ground at an inordinate rate. Many of the people in the cities have no idea where the water comes from when they turn on the faucet. It comes from the faucet, basically. A lot of people feel that way.
Right, and food comes from cans.
Now, one of the biggest factors that we're looking at right now, I've just been looking at the Ogallala Aquifer in Big Way, which is east of here. It's it's beneath the breadbasket of America, basically. And about a fifth of our grains come from those middle states that are served by the Ogallala Aquifer, and yet research reveals that entirely likely within the next 25 years that aquifer will be pumped out. Where will food come from then? In other words, we've grown to rely on food. However, that wasn't grown there just a little over 100 years ago. However, the human population is growing faster than our ability to be able to contend with it within the context of what's going to be sustainable. That also holds for energy production. It holds for just about everything. And as we can see right now, we're on the edge of a bunch of potentially failing milieus, so to speak. In other words, the energy milieu can really crunch down on us. The failing financial system, or at least it's not in a very healthy state right now, is another huge factor. If we look at that in connection with water and the fact that at this particular point in time, 50% of the human population lives in cities and is unaware of where food and water come from. We really have to figure out another way of educating ourselves as to how to survive.
One of the thinkers in your book said something which really hit home for me and probably a lot of people, which is that most people realize that there's a problem and most people want to do the right thing, but they don't have the information on how to do that.
Well, that's true. But partly what we have to do is identify the problems. And there was the single periodical to which I subscribe is The New Scientist. It's published in Britain, and what I love about it, it has a British bias rather than American bias. And they recently came up with a whole list of factors that we really have to contend with if we're going to not collapse as a civilization.
And what are some of those?
Okay, I've got them written down.
He's putting on his glasses.
One that I really hate the thought of is the possibility of terrorist attacks, especially on places like, I probably shouldn't even identify where they should be at this point, but at any rate, terrorist attacks.
Why, because the terrorists are listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe and they might get some ideas?
Well, let's face it, like on the various generating stations, the electrical generating stations, that's a whole very complex and actually fragile system. And it's even something bizarre like the master computer were to go down, you know, it could cause a glitch that could cause major problems. Now, another one is looking at things like the Hoover and Glen Canyon dams. You know, that water is stored there. A lot of us don't really like the presence of those dams much because that's a whole other conversation right there, what happens there. But The idea being, if anything happened there to those dams, like an earthquake or anything like that, a lot of water would go away. And a lot of people don't realize that up to 65% of Los Angeles water comes from the Colorado River. Even water in Albuquerque comes from the Colorado River. This is something by way of the San Juan Chama diversion, that whole watershed. If an economic depression of the magnitude that we saw back in the 1930s occurred, that would also throw us in a state of panic. If a pandemic were to occur, that could be really grim, because we just... My mother actually had the influenza. She survived the influenza epidemic of the late teens, 19-teens. But that took out a lot of people. And if that ran rampant in a megalopolitan area, or even a big city like Albuquerque, let's say looking at Phoenix and LA and places like that, Denver, a pandemic could be really critical, because a workforce that may have the techno-savvy to make our digital world occur could be really grimly affected that way. The biggest problem that we're facing right now in the world is global warming and climate change and the inevitability of drought. And that is something that we just really have to start thinking about. Breakdown of technological savvy, because fewer and fewer people have the technological understanding to be able to keep all of this stuff running. One of the biggest things that I worry about is if any of our storage capacities, like a Google storage capacity or any of that kind of digital storage capacity, if that began to break down, how would we run? You know, this is so new. 20 years ago, we didn't live in this digital world as we do now. That's a big factor. And then looking at just a combination of any of those different things occurring concurrently could be really grim. So what we have to do is look at the array of possible factors. And this is what I'm trying to say. When people accuse one of being a doomsayer, which I'm certainly not, what I'm trying to say is that people who say that are basically in a state of denial, not mustering the imagination to confront the evidence that we're looking at. And so that would be the first step, is to look at these different factors to see what we really do have to contend with. And then reacting in a way that, to me, one of the biggest things that we really should be thinking of is we've invested so much of our political power in a centralized fashion, and to me this is really the wrong thing to do. I look at decentralization as being absolutely vital. One of my favorite people, political scientists in this planet, is in this book. His name is Daniel Kemmes. He's a really intelligent man.
The former mayor of Missoula, Montana, of all things.
Yes, he is. And he understands that our political system itself is too massive, too centralized, and that we really need to go back to what John Wesley Powell saw back in the 19th century, which is to organize our political, basically our political arenas within the context of our home watersheds or our home bioregions, which is a term that was coined back around 1970. It's a good word. And so if we can begin to resurrect a grassroots relationship within our respective cultural milieu, right around here, for example. In other words, if those of us who live in Santa Fe or Santa Fe County can really begin to become more and more active, more and more aware of what we have to contend with. In other words, part of that means using less and less water and using what water we do use as wisely as possible. That way we stand a chance against this coming system of dilemmas.
We're talking about Jack Loeffler. Talking to Jack Loeffler about his book, Survival Along the Continental Divide. I find myself wondering, I mean, it is important to become aware, and there are many people in Santa Fe is one of the most active activist communities probably anywhere in the country anyway. And so we have this awareness, and we're, you know, saving our little droplets of water, even though residential water use is literally a drop in the bucket of the big picture. There still remain the questions, and we can start engaging in watershed thinking and understand where our water comes from. But, you know, what are, in terms of making an actual difference in terms of survival, it seems to me that large political actions are much more important than little tiny home, you know, changes that you make in your home. Yeah, you put in the low flow toilets, or you fix your water leaks or whatever, but that's just a part, and probably a small part of the bigger picture in terms of making a sustainable life for ourselves. I mean, that's based on much larger infrastructures than our individual houses.
Well, to that extent, if we look at the political system as it presently exists, what we have to do is to make sure that the people that we elect to public office are as conscious as they can possibly be. To me, I don't know, this really gets kind of the heart of what I really think. I think that if we have a purpose, if indeed a purpose exists for our species, is to try to achieve as high a level of consciousness as we possibly can, and then use that consciousness in a way that's commensurate with living within the context of our planetary habitat. Now,
there was an interesting moment in the interview with Rena Swensel where she talks about in the essential thinking of Pueblo culture and the give and take between human beings and the greater forces of nature, like the interaction between human beings and the weather, human beings and astronomical phenomena. Now, the weather and astronomical phenomena were here a long, long time before us. We're a tiny second on the, you know, in the day of the Earth's history, much less the solar system. And so that was something that I think somebody with a kind of scientific worldview would say, oh, goodness, that's nonsense. How do you understand that give and take between, you know, the clouds and us, the planets and us? I mean, you know, we can understand them, but, you know, the idea that it's a mutual relationship?
Well, to me, it's obvious that it's a mutual relationship. And as much as we are part of the flow of nature, we are not separate from that. We have managed to evolve.
But we influence the sun? We influence the planets?
No, we don't influence the sun. Or maybe we do without knowing it. But we are influenced by the sun. And we are living, to me, the largest ecosystem that I can comfortably get my mind wrapped around is the solar system. One of the things that I really think is that we have become so anthropocentrically oriented. We think we're the whole reason to be. And obviously, as you say, we are 1 second in the day of reality. In other words, if life appeared on the planet 3.5 billion years ago, which is the current scientific evidence, and I have a great belief in scientific evidence, or I trust it to a great extent. It's the application of it sometimes that I really disagree with. But the point being that we have to recognize, this is what the indigenous people understand, is that we are part of the flow of nature. We are not separate from it. Robinson Jeffers had a wonderful phrase in one of his poems, "Not man apart." We are not apart from nature, even though very little of our attention reflects the fact that we are part of the flow of nature. To me, probably one of the greatest philosophical systems that ever came along was Taoism, because basically that's understanding the relationship within the natural context. So that is an aspect that I think that we really have to look to these people who truly understand it. Perhaps we don't affect the planet Jupiter, but it certainly has captivated a huge amount of our attention, especially as we send out craft to go examine these things. We are a part of that. If you go back and look at something like the Big Bang, for example, which is what many scientists believe, many physicists believe, would have been the moment of the origin of our current universe, we're a part of that. Our atomic structure hails from that first few minutes or whatever it was,
right?
You know, and when we die, our molecules and our atoms rearrange themselves, however they will be rearranged. within the context of our current planet. Thus far, as far as we know, nothing that has been born on this planet has been buried on the moon, you know.
Not yet.
Not yet. We're trying. But the point being is that it's the bigger picture. It's not just us. It's how do we factor ourselves into the bigger picture of these things? And we are part of the flow of nature. There's just simply no getting away from that. If the universe didn't exist, our tiny little mini speck of it wouldn't exist.
Now, a chunk of your book is devoted to the New Deal.
Yes.
Why?
Well, let me talk about that a little bit. First of all, I need to say one thing. On page 263 of this book is a misprint, and I want to make very clear that Fran Levine, when she wrote the essay which ends this book, knows full well that the Taos people speak Tiwa, not Tewa.
Oh, okay.
Some copy editor put in the wrong vowel in T-E-W-A. It should be T-I-W-A, and I really want to make that clear. Actually, the genesis of this book came from a conversation between myself and Craig Newbill, who's the director of the New Mexico Humanities Council and a good man. And I had been doing a whole bunch of lecturing about a notion known as between fences that originated with the Smithsonian Institution. And he asked me if I'd be up for doing a book that would factor in this whole business of boundaries. And I look here at cultural boundaries, but also factor in the New Deal. Well, I had to think about that for a bit. I said yes instantly because it's always a challenge. And to me, the leitmotif is the land itself. But at any rate, the New Deal deals with New Mexico and New Mexico ways of looking at reality. And one of the things that really interested me, a little bit about the New Deal, was generated by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Starting around 1932 when he was elected, he defeated President Hoover, Herbert Hoover. And we were in the midst, we were really in dire straits economically. The Great Depression was on, a depression that lasted for 11 years and resulted in bread lines and total dismay and despair throughout the United States. The places which were least affected were the rural areas, of which New Mexico was one. And it interested me that during that span of time, we went from a subsistence culture where we grew food. This is before I was born, actually. Hard to believe. But at any rate, food was grown. People hunted. People lived on the land in a way. They understood that the land sustained them. With the coming of the New Deal, money started coming into New Mexico to pay for all sorts of great things like the CCC, the Civilian Conservation Corps, the Works Projects Administration, various things. Even artists and writers were funded to do all sorts of good stuff. But what it did was bring in the economic paradigm that had come to prevail throughout the rest of the citified United States and supplant the subsistence level that we were accustomed to. Now, one of the interviews in this book is with Stuart Udall, an old and dear friend of mine who was born in St. John's, Arizona, just on the other side of the Continental Divide, mind you. And Stuart talks about how he grew up in a place where they grew their food, they hunted. They felt the depression, but they weren't brought to the ground. They weren't brought to their knees by it. The good side of the New Deal is that it really helped restore an awful lot of good stuff here in New Mexico. And one of the things that fascinates me, and
it helped restore what kind of things?
It helped restore, let's put it this way, one of the things that it really helped do was bring the writers involved, went out and they interviewed people who had lived in earlier times, like in the 19th century. And so there was true oral history as to how it was in the 19th century. As a matter of fact, there's a new book out called Outlaws and Desperados by Ann Lacy and Ann Valley Fox, based on interviews done by the writers and talking about those desperate times in the 19th century. But a lot of the actual conservation stuff that has come to prevail as part of the paradigm for conservation really came into effect during the New Deal. The CCC people, Civilian Conservation Corps, really employed a lot of young men and young women, it turns out. When the young men would go out and riprap arroyos to keep erosion from happening and replanting trees from where stuff had been cut down, and big projects like that just peppered the state of New Mexico and actually helped keep our environment in a stable way, even during the time of the Dust Bowl, which occurred concurrently, where in the east of here, over in Oklahoma and those states that are above the Oglala Aquifer, where people have been doing dry farming, the winds had come and dumped Oklahoma on top of us, basically, with the Dust Bowl. I just saw a photograph of that. Great, it's like a tsunami of dust coming into Clayton, New Mexico. But the point being is that here, we really were able to create a sense of conservation and preservation of our natural habitat in a really solid way. And this was something brought to us by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And apropos of that, the very first interview in this book is with Paul Horgan, whom I really regard as being, his book Great River still is the best book on history in this region that prevails. But at any rate, in that interview with Paul Horgan, one of the things that he said is that in this time, and I conducted that interview back in 1986, he said, we need somebody to lead this nation who has the scope of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he said, and I see absolutely nobody on the political horizon with that kind of scope. In other words, what Roosevelt did was introduce the New Deal to the United States of America in order to respond to an enormous catastrophe, a financial catastrophe, an economic catastrophe. And what I'm trying to say in this book, by having included some of these different things, is that we need a new deal to come in. It has to be a collaborative effort between politicians and everybody else. But we have to do it consciously, and we have to do it as unselfishly as possible. In other words, the motivation to buy greed has got to end.
It's interesting because in the Stuart Udall interview, he talks about how a lot of the things that we take for granted as being our absolute birthright, like health care, are products of the New Deal, before which people took care of themselves and really suffered the consequences when they couldn't, you know, heal themselves or their families.
That's absolutely true. For example, at my age, I'll be 72 in July, but I have Social Security, and I also have Medicare, and these are wonderful things to take help with the burden of existence, you know, as you grow older. Fortunately, I'm in pretty good shape, and so I'm doing well health-wise, but when I look at people who don't have the benefit of health insurance these days and facing the enormous rise in health costs, I realize that what Roosevelt did was fantastic, but we need to do a lot more. In other words, that's one area where the political system could do a heck of a lot more for the population of this country. As a major power in this world, we are far behind other evolved systems, cultural systems, as far as healthcare and that kind of thing is concerned. But by the same token, we have to pull our own weight, and we have to pull it in a way that's commensurate with the habitat itself.
And learning how to do that is a long process that you can't just sort of learn in the course of one radio interview. I mean, you've been at this your whole life.
Absolutely, and I haven't mastered it by any stretch, but I've certainly tried to live in as minimal a fashion as I possibly can. And even so, I realize that I live in a luxurious way relative to people who preceded me on this planet. But we're going to have to simplify. We're going to have to simplify. We're going to have to reduce human population. This is a huge issue, I know, with many religious systems, but it's one that, in other words, if we continue to grow, we're doomed. We have to really learn birth control.
We're talking to Jack Loeffler. Now, this book of interviews, it's an interesting thing to go from the interview format to a print format. Sometimes reading some of these interviews, you hear their voices, and you're dying to hear the audio book. I mean, presumably you recorded these interviews and transcribed them. Are you going to make this available either as a radio program or an audio book?
Well, there is a radio series that came out 6 or 8 months ago called The Lore of the Land, which was up on the NPR satellite for a while and is available through Public Radio Exchange. And actually, I want to bring one by KSFR in the hopes that it might be able to be broadcast here. And a lot of the interviews in this book are excerpted for that radio series, I think. Yes, they are. And it is. It's wonderful. One of the things, as you know, being a radio person, that when you're reading something that somebody has said, you don't hear it being spoken. And it's that tone which is lost. And you get the feeling, the gestalt of it. Actually, Edward O. Wilson and Paul Shepherd, two of my great heroes, both claimed that listening, hearing, is the most deeply penetrating of the senses. And I really believe that. And subsequently,
images sort of come and go, but what you hear, and above all, what you say, sticks with you.
It sure does. And the imagery, in other words, eyesight is sort of peripatetic. It just goes here, there, and everywhere. But the continuum is what you're hearing. And so listening to what these people had to say when I was recording the interviews, in large major conversations as I was having them, I could hear these wonderful things go by that I wanted to put into radio, and I have. And that series, The Lore of the Land, and this book were projects under the same banner. And they were funded by National Endowment for the Humanities and the Ford Foundation, and sponsored by the New Mexico Humanities Council and the New Mexico Department of Cultural Affairs. They all came under that banner, but the idea was that you could read the book and then you could hear elements of what's being said in the book, spoken by these people. For example, Warner Glenn telling the story of spotting the jaguar.
The rancher, yeah.
Yes, he's a great man, a wonderful man, who is really fighting to keep that that wildlife corridor open.
Well, and that's another thing, that particular interview was so interesting because he was a rancher who really early on said, let's work with the bureaucratic entities who are charged with taking care of the land rather than working against them. And they were very receptive because ranchers hadn't approached them before.
That's true. Part of that whole gang was Drummond Hadley, who owns the Gray Ranch, which is a huge ranch down in the Boot Heel of New Mexico. And Drum and Warner Glenn and others formed a group known as the Malpai Border Group, which is right along the Mexican border. And their whole notion was to factor ranching into taking care of habitat rather than trashing it, as has happened in the 19th century especially, when we overgraze like mad. But the ranchers, after generations of having ranched, really understand that they have to steward land rather than trash it. Otherwise, the land won't sustain them.
And one person in the book, now I can't remember who it was, said that the land is actually better off now than it was 100 years ago, that we reached our sort of nadir in land use 100 years ago. That seemed amazing to me.
That was Melissa Savage, a biogeographer,
yeah,
who is really a wise lady. And it's true. And one of the model groups is the Malpai Border Group, of which Warner is a member. One of the things, I spent a lot of good time down there. When I was talking to Warner, and he had told me about his life as a rancher and what the seasonal cycles were about and what you had to think about and all of that sort of thing, and how you have to harvest water and be careful about water, he has to support himself in part as a mountain lion guide, hunter. And he was out one time with his mules, and there he saw this jaguar. He got pictures of the jaguar. He actually sent me one of these photographs that he'd taken of the jaguar. Concurrently, on the other side of the Continental Divide, over around Tucson, another friend of mine, Jack Childs, who's also an old cowboy, has spotted jaguar. And between the two of them, they're really doing a lot of work in behalf of trying to make it possible for the jaguars to continue to use the southern New Mexico, southern Arizona habitat to which they were formerly accustomed.
Jack Loeffler, unfortunately, it's time to go now. It's been wonderful to have you here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Oh, Mary Charlotte, thank you so much for inviting me. This has been fun.
Jack Loeffler is a writer, oral historian, and radio producer. His latest book is Survival Along the Continental Divide, an anthology of interviews. And it's published by the University of New Mexico Press, and he will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore in Santa Fe this Friday, May 23rd at 5:30 in the afternoon. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz presents the monthly New Orleans Hour. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. See you later. Ciao.